Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Doubt, uncertainty, and the unknown are part of human experience. Both are universal and we all experience it. Science, politics, and even how we see ourselves includes elements of doubt and second guessing. While we may think of doubt and uncertainty as a negative, there are upsides too. We discuss the positive and negative sides of uncertainty and how doubt operates in today's culture. With us, Amy Bernstein. She's the author of Wrangling the Doubt Monster, Fighting Fears, Finding Inspiration. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you, Mindy. I'm glad to be here.
And Maggie Jackson, who's the author of Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. Welcome back, Maggie.
Thank you. Terrific to be here.
So what's the difference between doubt and uncertainty? And how would you define each of these sort of mindsets and concepts? Amy, let's start with doubt.
Doubt is almost a collection of emotions that we very rarely name. We call them many other things. We may call them anxiety. We may call them fear. And doubt is sort of a particular emotion that really settles into us when we are so questioning every choice that we're making. We're questioning our very reality. We're questioning our competence. And these questions tend to bubble up and kind of roll around each other and end up shaping very negative, repetitive thoughts in our heads that sort of have us question whether we even know what we're doing, whether that's existential or literally, you know, when to cross the street with the walk light or whether to jaywalk. So it can be big and small, and it's something that really builds up in us, and we rarely sort of call it out for what it is.
Yeah, kind of thing like you get in your head, right? Yes. All right, Maggie, what about uncertainty?
Great. Yes. Uncertainty, of course, seems synonymous with disaster, and it's sort of a lament right now. But actually, uncertainty, there are two main kinds of uncertainty. That's important to know. There's, first of all, our the uncertainty out there, the unpredictability, the volatility. That's what humans can't know, even though they might have great mathematical models and AI data, et cetera. But then there's our uncertainty, our psychological uncertainty. And that's, I think, the most important because it's the human response to the unknown. So when humans meet anything new, unexpected, or ambiguous, they get the chance to reach the limits of their understanding. So the example I like to use is maybe a storm is coming your way and you might have great, you know, weather predictions, but you don't know whether it's going to, you know, do X amount of damage or whether you should evacuate. And in that situation, you are feeling caught short, you're uneasy, which is natural because we evolve to need and want answers. So you literally feel stressed and uneasy and uncomfortable in around uncertainty. But at the same time, you know, you might evacuate or you might go back to sleep. You might put on the shutters, you might not. So within the space of uncertainty are many possibilities. That's where the action lies. And despite the discomfort, you know, scientists actually call uncertainty a space of possibilities. So it's a little bit reaching the edge of your understanding, but it has a lot of positives that we also don't recognize in our society today.
Yeah.
If I could just add to that, I think doubt in a way is the nervous system's response, the autonomic response, even the old brain response to a lot of what Maggie is articulating. And doubt and self-doubt, we're often very inarticulate about that state, which is kind of what I was alluding to, because we don't often put names to it. And I think Maggie is sort of giving us sort of a window on how to think about uncertainty. And doubt is almost like the body's inarticulate response to that uncertainty in certain circumstances.
Yeah. We talk about self-doubt. I think, you know, many of us, right, have grappled with self-doubt, that nagging voice questioning our worth or abilities. And so many women in particular seem to suffer from that. And that we would call, I don't know if it's doubt, but imposter syndrome, right? Very accomplished. You know, you have the skills and it's, but you know, that doubt kind of creeps in there. And then again, what I was saying to you, Amy, you kind of get into your own head, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, you bring up how this affects women, perhaps compared to men. And, you know, many decades ago, Carol Gilligan, who was a Harvard researcher at the time, and many others doing research at the time, really connected the dots for us with how this works with women. And they she really captivated Gilligan in particular, how societal norms and gender socialization particularly led women to internalize feelings of self-doubt and uncertainty, and really kind of affected our ability to give voice to our own feelings and to assert that. And while, of course, a lot has changed since then, many things have not changed, and women are still more willing than men to articulate doubt, which is a vulnerable state to be in. So in some ways, it's an owning it, which women are more willing to do than men. But then there's also still, this is still happening. These cultural pressures do still exist on women. And, you know, we would ignore that at our peril. There was a Harvard Business School study just last year that found that women are less likely to apply for a job if they feel they don't meet 100% of the requirements, whereas a man will apply if he feels he meets at least half or a little more than half. And so these feelings of self-doubt really do persist among women, perhaps more than men, and it's something we do need to pay attention to.
Yeah. When you're talking about the how culture around us shapes our self-doubt, this is not just in our country, right? This is worldwide. How culture can impact our doubt, right?
I think so. And I think, Maggie, you probably have more exposure to some of this in other cultures than I do. But I do think that certainly in what we would think of as Western cultures, because I don't want to speak for cultures that I don't know, it's absolutely, I would say, endemic. And of course, it goes to the larger forces at work here, the cultural pressures, AI, which perhaps we'll get into. Mm-hmm. There are so many reasons that we're in an age of doubt, and that's affecting cultures really across the world.
Maggie, what do you think?
I have lived experience. I've lived in Japan as a reporter for multiple years and London and worked all over the world. And I would say, generally speaking, you know, we can't completely universalize these issues, but I'd say doubt and uncertainty are basic human faculties. They really are double-edged, and both have their limits. One of the ways that we can also get a handle on these two states of mind is to think about the limits. Basically, you know, we wouldn't want anyone to be uncertain about where their next meal was coming from. You know, uncertainty is not a privilege. I consider it a human right, because it is the doorway, the vehicle to resilience and to adaptability. And when we open up the space between question and answer, we can then explore, we can be curious, we can wonder. And so there's so much that's lost in our current kind of allergy to uncertainty. Similarly with doubt, you know, you doubt is fantastic for the questioning, the Socratic method, the, you know, ancient Greeks. Where would we be without doubt? If we accepted everything as is, well, we're narrowing ourselves, lowering ourselves as human thinkers. But at the same time, when you're just clouded with doubt, weighed down by doubt, that's where it certainly comes into play. And I think that, I mean, it's interesting too, just to add a little counterweight, or I don't know, I've never seen any, in years of studies, I've never seen any studies that show that there are gender differences with uncertainty, but uncertainty is the larger umbrella concept here. So, you know, there could be gender differences in some ways, but it's also a fallacy that there are gender differences in terms of our language in and around of uncertainty, expressions of uncertainty, it's called. The word maybe, for instance, sometimes could, in the business world and organizations, that's seen as, you know, something that is a no-no. You know, leaders wouldn't want to say, maybe we should do this. It makes them seem weak. True, but at the same time, there aren't gender differences between male and female use of maybe. It's not that women, you know, are constantly trotting out the word maybe. But the more important news is that even this tiny little expression of uncertainty is actually not. Does not undermine you as a leader, as a business person. So studies out of Harvard have showed that leaders in difficult discussions who use the words like maybe actually seen as more approachable as better teammates. So again, we are seeing a positive side to uncertainty. And the linguists say that the word maybe, again, signals receptivity to others' points of view. Wow, couldn't be more important today.
Yeah.
and then secondly, signals that there's something more to know, signals that you're at the edge of what you know. So that's a fantastic signal. That's really a fantastic piece of communications that you'd want on a team or in a sticky situation.
Yeah.
So I think that that's really important for all leaders, no matter where they come from, to learn.
Yeah, makes sense. So experiencing doubt, of course, to one degree or another, is normal, as a normal part of human experience. So what's different about the way doubt operates in our culture now compared to the past?
Certainly fair to say that doubt has always, it's part of the human condition, right? We question ourselves, we question the world around us. I mean, that's a survival mechanism, most fundamentally. And of course, it's something we're always going to do. But I think you could make the case that we're in what I call the age of doubt, because we have unprecedented access to information, to images, to data, to facts, to access to lived experiences or access to experiences proximately than we've ever had before in human history. And rather than this making us more secure and more assured of our self-knowledge, although that happens obviously in certain respects, it also is fertile ground for making us doubt nearly everything. And there are so many surveys now that show this. I mean, we doubt, people doubt climate change, both in terms of when it's going to happen, the severity of it, whether it's happening. We doubt whether American democracy is going to survive. We doubt whether government is functioning honestly or effectively. A Pew Research study earlier this year found that we doubt our neighbors' trustworthiness. Only 46% of people trust some of their neighbors. And certainly when it comes to conversations about politics, we're doubting when a fact is a fact, because we are now all have our own facts. So to me, it's a ratcheting up of a natural state, of a normal part of the human condition. And when you throw AI into the mix, this is a ratcheting up of the capacity for self-doubt and to really question just not only ourselves, but question everything happening around us and our place in the world, what we truly believe, what we need to believe, what we ought to believe, whether what we believe is even true, and even the difference between a belief and a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so the doubts are just ramped up, certainly in a 24/7 media culture like the one that we live in.
Yeah. So Maggie, how does modern tech-centric living, including AI, exacerbate what you call the rising allergy to uncertainty, and why does it matter?
Yes, it's a, if we have cultivated and utilized doubt to a, you know, negative degree, if we're wielding doubt, you know, to in order to not trust, in order to, I think, stay on the islands of our comfortable knowledge, you know, by constantly taking down others' opinions, by thinking of science as something that's you know, built on sand instead of solid ground, we then basically shore up our own, you know, comfort zone. And that's exactly what happens when we are fearful of uncertainty. So, you know, anxiety is actually, clinically speaking, a fear of the unknown. And so by sticking to what's comfortable, we see it in echo chambers online, we see it in evidence shows that people have, there's evidence that our so-called intolerance of uncertainty, that's the fear of uncertainty, is rising. So yes, I mean, and then that kind of instigates this overuse of perhaps doubt as a cudgel rather than a, you know, wonderful cognitive prosthetic, so to speak. So, you know, I think technology does have a role to play in this. You know, technology, for instance, I think I see the rising allergy to uncertainty that's all around us as built on hundreds of years, especially in the West, but globally too, emphasis on speed and efficiency. The very rationalist definition of intelligence is a being that follows the most linear path to an outcome. You know, what is smart is to be efficient. And that leads us to look for, and technology offers us, neat, pat, instant answers, those crisp little templates, the PowerPoint bullet points. That's what we think knowing is. And we've forgotten the murky, muddy mystery, the space between the question and answer again, where again, the possibilities lie. And AI, it's so interesting because while uncertainty is a provocation. It's literally good stress, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But while AI is a provocation, it literally, jolts you from your assumptions. You are basically provoked. It's a lever toward the wonder and the curiosity and the questioning that we need in a complicated world. AI today, by study after study, early, preliminary, but yet solid MIT studies and others show that AI offers deference. It's sycophantic. It's offering, it's affirming what we already know, therefore allowing us to stick to those islands of our knowledge and not venture forth where it's uncomfortable. So now more, and of course the tech industry's historic emphasis has been on friction-free seamlessness, as Zuckerberg has emphasized. So, I mean, do we want a comfortable, easy, lolling on the sofa of what we already know? Or do we want to move forward and to come up with the ideas and the, creative, epiphanies that we need, the constructed knowledge that we need to face the challenges of our day? And so the provocation of uncertainty, and I'd say doubt, can be wielded as a productive force, and it's all the more needed as we head blindly into this AI world where we're using it in ways that really make us complacent. This is so true in the workplace. It's so true at home, too.
All right. Talk about the good stress.
Good stress. I'm so excited to talk about the good stress of uncertainty because, yes, you need and want answers. That's how you evolved. You need to resolve, with this, any discussion of uncertainty is not about remaining in limbo as we fear, but actually physiologically and cognitively, uncertainty unleashes. So when you meet something new or uncertain or ambiguous or unexpected, your body and brain react. They literally spring into action. So what's new is that scientists have begun to discover that when you're unsure, your attention sharpens. So emergency room doctors who are in sticky clinical situations and who admit being unsure also say their attention is heightened, which of course is a good thing. Our working memory goes up. I mean, literally, we are rising to the occasion. That's not comfortable, but it's very distinct from fear. So one neuroscientist told me, Joseph Cable of UPenn told me, uncertainty is the brain telling itself there's something to be learned here. This is not something you want to or need to remain in all your lifelong days, every minute of the day, because it's to equip you to face the unknown for the times when things are new or murky. And so the good stress of uncertainty is something we need to lean into. One takeaway or granular way we can do that is to ratchet down our culture and our individual emphasis on outcome, from efficiency. So if we're in the middle of a tennis game and we're already thinking about whether or not we're going to win or lose, well, we're not going to be playing as well. We're not present to the moment. And uncertainty is literally a way to be present to the moment. So try to dial back on outcome fixation. Think about the being in present in the moment, and you'll actually be able to tap into that good stress of uncertainty.
Go ahead.
And I was going to say, outcome fixation is truly, and you highlighted several of them, Maggie, it's one of the downfalls of what happens in creative communities among artists whose work and whose processes are out of step with so many cultural norms about efficiency, measurable productivity, foreseeable and measurable outcomes, success measures that are tangible, that translate into money and title and power and prestige. These things are all out of step as cultural norms with respect to how artists work their own process. And so self-doubt is so prevalent in creative communities because of this disconnect. And so doubt, you talk about doubt being used as a cudgel, unfortunately, which we use, you know, against one another, but it's also so much, you know, getting back to the sort of the deep emotional state of it, it's so much a cudgel that we use against ourselves, and leading to things like depression and procrastination, poor or postponed decision-making, analysis paralysis. And so I know you were talking about all the upsides, and I'm back to sort of like the downsides, but I mean, there's an absolute yin and yang here. There's no question. I was reading some work by some brain researchers who were studying parents who are new parents. And if the parents feel that being a parent is a deeply, deeply meaningful life experience, that is sort of fulfills their own sense of self-narrative, then the doubts they encounter with all these new experiences, you know, is the baby eating enough? Is the baby sleeping enough? All these things, have I buckled the car seat properly? Those doubts function in that protective way that you were talking about. It's the upside, it's the opportunity to learn and make sure that you're doing well. And it's the most sort of natural protective side of doubt and uncertainty, and functions well in that context. So it's definitely all of the above situation.
Yeah. We're discussing the positive and negative sides of uncertainty and doubt. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the positive and negative sides of uncertainty and doubt. With us is Amy Bernstein. She's the author of Wrangling the Doubt Monster, Fighting Fears, Finding Inspiration, and Maggie Jackson, who's the author of Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Amy, so how do we use doubt as fuel?
Doubt can be a deeply inspirational wellspring, sort of speaking to Maggie's upsides of these things. I always talk about walking with your doubts. And so if you acknowledge to yourself that you have doubtful states, that you have unanswered questions, that you are experiencing fear and uncertainty sort of at a personal psychological level, what you can do is acknowledge those states, admit that they are there, admit that they perhaps even trouble you, and then you basically sort of look past them and focus on the thing that you really, really want to do most, the thing that your passion draws you on to do, and tell yourself, I have doubts about what I'm doing. I have doubts about its value. I have doubts about my own competence, but passion drives me to do this thing that I want to do. I want to write. I want to paint. I want to open a bakery. I want to start a company, and I'm going to pursue that and walk with the doubts. So it can fuel you in the sense of acknowledging the degree to which you are embarking on risk and risk taking. And risk taking can be very deeply exhilarating. It can be terrifying, but it can also really be a spur to help you discover things about yourself that you did not know, to find capacities that you did not know you had, to explore the reaches of your talent that you didn't know you possessed. And so it can be a very propelling kind of state to be in if we don't simply listen to the fear side of all of that. Mm-hmm. So it can indeed propel us onward.
You have a lot of great quotes in the book. And one that stood out for me is from Elaine Welterotha. It says, there is always more waiting for you on the other side of fear. And that's exactly what you're talking about right now.
That's so true. And the thing is, you have to remind yourself of this sometimes on a daily, if not even an hourly basis, because, you know, fear being the primal thing, the primal urge that it is, you know, connected to survival and, you know, making sure that we get out of the way of the beast that's chasing us when we've dropped our spear. You have to remember that there are these other ways that that kind of fear functions on our behalf. And it is a goad in the best sense of the word. It's a way for us to challenge ourselves. And Elaine Welteroth had it right, which is why I picked that quote among many in particular, because if you focus on where you want to get to, and that doesn't even have to be a goal, it can even just be a feeling, a way you want to feel. It doesn't have to be, well, I'm going to have my art in every gallery, I'm going to sell a million copies of my book. It doesn't have to be like that. It can be the sense of, I'm going to complete this task, I'm going to complete this work, I'm going to fulfill this vision because I'm called to do it, and I'm going to walk with the doubts despite everything.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking when you're talking about, you know, the risk and, you know, you have these doubts, is it going to work? And think of any entrepreneur who has started out on any kind of venture. Exactly. It's always risky, right? And there's always doubt and there's always uncertainty. But the reward on the other side of that is worth that risk, right?
And a lot of that reward, frankly, is self-knowledge, new self-knowledge. You learn more about yourself through hardship, through taking risks, through walking with those fears than you do by playing itself and by hanging back. And, you know, as Maggie says, by not asking the questions. Brené Brown talks about asking leaders to ask exquisite questions. Find out what you don't know. Don't assume that you do know. You need to really probe. And that can be scary in and of itself. That's almost a vulnerable point of exposure to begin to ask questions, because you are readily admitting, I don't know this.
Yeah. If somebody is a persistent self-doubter, how might that affect their everyday life?
It does affect everyday life. And I've talked to so many people, particularly in the creative professions, who what they're doing is, unfortunately, they're playing and replaying tapes that they grew up with. These persistent self-doubters very often grew up in family situations where they were not emotionally and psychologically supported. They may have been physically safe, but they were not supported. So they were, they're people who've been told by their parents well into adulthood, you amount to nothing. This art thing that you're doing, this is no, mm-hmm. no, this is not going to happen. You need to go find a real profession. And so they're undermined at every turn and not supported. And that sets up these recurring negative tapes that I've talked to adults well into their 60s and 70s who are still telling me that their father's voice is in their head saying, you're stupid, you're not going to amount to anything. And they're struggling to write.
Yeah.
And why are they struggling to write? Because they can't connect. The creative urge is there, and they can't get past the doubt that's screaming so loudly in their heads.
I just want to say the opposite. I had a mother who I literally, honestly thought I could do anything in the world, right? Because my mother always told me that. And so I, you know, and I look back now, I go, man, was I naive in some of those situations? But I was like, hey, I could do it too, right? So, I mean, it's amazing the impact that those words can have on you in your childhood if somebody's, you know, supportive of that. Yeah, go ahead, Maggie.
Yeah, I think that also I'd add that one way to help, which I love the idea of walking with doubt, and similarly, you know, utilizing uncertainty as a productive force, but not letting it run away with your life is two things. One, I think to remember the dynamism of life. The reason we are updating our understanding of the world when we meet something new is because, you know, you need to change along with the world. And so if you're stuck in the sort of prison of your thoughts, assuming that something will be bad, assuming that the blind date will fail, assuming that your new business will fail, you know, then you are not actually being honest. You know, C.S. Lewis has this wonderful quote about experience is basically a form of honesty. Experience is basically, you know, a kind of is going to be honest with you. And I think I call uncertainty a form of honesty, because when you're able to attune with the world, then you realize the dynamism of the world. And I think that's a very Buddhist philosophy. That's a very, you know, a philosophy from Eastern areas of the globe. And sometimes that gets lost in the West. And the second thing I'd say is that one thing I learned as a work family balance columnist early on, when this was a new beat in the newsrooms, was that, you know, incremental is fine. When a woman asks for flexible work, and her boss, says categorically no, the boss is usually assuming that means she's going to be here or there, or maybe work flexibly. Well, it could be mean that she just wants to leave early on a Friday. So incremental is really what uncertainty offers you, the ability to construct knowledge. It's experimental. So I spent time with surgeons in operating rooms and the best of the best performers are adaptive experts. Those are the people who know when and how to be unsure. Those are the people who experiment in the moment when there's a crisis rather than handing down their same old neat pat old knowledge that they've done 1,000 times. So I think the incremental is really important too. Maybe step one will lead me in a different direction. Maybe step one will avert this, tell me that I'm wrong at this point. But step 2, 3, 4, 15, is where you are beginning to build the right way. So I think, that goes back to the technology, the sort of frameworks of technology that we have. We think of things as binary. Oh, you're an entrepreneur, you're successful, or you're not, or you're famous in the world, which was what a lot of young people now, rather than strive for a meaningful life, as studies show they wanted in the 60s, 70s, whatever. Now it's very high levels want fame and riches, and they also see it as binary. You are or you aren't, and that's not how life is. Life is a process.
And our brains are wired to predict outcomes based on our experiences. So what are your thoughts on thinking through a positive potential? You've got this uncertainty of what might be, but that positive thinking. And I'm a big believer in the impact of positive thinking, but I wonder what your thoughts are.
Yes, I was actually going to raise that issue of the way the brain works, and necessarily so, is to do predictive processing. So in other words, when you get up in the morning, you know where your kitchen is. It hasn't been moved, except in that hotel room in the dark when you landed and you don't know where the bathroom is. But your mind is constantly predicting and assuming. And that's good because that allows us to be to smoothly move through life without reinventing the wheel every minute. But when you meet something new, your brain, erupts in what's called a brainwave called a prediction error. And that's really uncertainty. The prediction error is there's a gap between what you predicted or assumed and this new reality. There's a tiger in the parking lot, or you've got a new boss and nobody told you, or something like that. And so life has these times when our predictions fall short. And I think that that's really an exciting, important kind of new framing of what uncertainty is. It points the way to how it is opportunity. And I think that does make it a lot more exciting and positive when you can think of, well, my inclination or my assumption about this. And all of this also drives the importance of uncertainty as open-mindedness. And I think doubt can be wielded to attain open-mindedness, because if you wield your doubt well, you are expanding the framework of your understanding, one of the markers of an adaptive expert. So I think that's also very important when we so often misunderstand others, where we fall back today on stereotypes, when we fall back on the, them versus us, another kind of categorization and binariness. At that moment, all we need to do sometimes is, for instance, a very strong, psychological strategy is to do perspective taking, is to try to see the world through another's eyes. Studies show that allows us to be, allows us, it inspires us to engage with people whose politics we hate. It inspires us to make contact, which erodes prejudice, etc. So that open-mindedness is a social act as well, and that's really important.
Yeah, Amy, what are your thoughts?
Experience builds on experience. If you have even a very small win, you're in fact not rich and famous, but you have, for example, just completed your first short story, let's say. When you have a small win, that opens the door for more wins. And so so much of this is pattern making, and so much of this is mindset management. Some of us tap into therapy to help us with mindset changes and mindset management. And some of us can do some of this on our own. But I think that we can set up these patterns for ourselves where if you can get small wins, and by win, I mean you simply feel fulfilled in the moment, fulfilled that you have completed a task or you stretched yourself or even surprised yourself, that is instantly the groundwork for more wins. Mm-hmm. And so you may still be walking with doubt, but you're getting this other side of the ledger, so to speak. And you can continue to build on that. It's so important to focus on those small wins, one thing at a time. And it doesn't matter what it is. It just has to feel good.
Yeah. We're discussing the positive and negative sides of uncertainty and doubt. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the positive and negative sides of uncertainty and doubt with Amy Bernstein. She's the author of Wrangling the Doubt Monster, Fighting Fears, Finding Inspiration, and Maggie Jackson, who's the author of Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So along with this uncertainty and doubt, sometimes the unexpected, a surprise, Maggie, happens, right? Talk about surprises.
Exactly. I mean, again, when we're in that unusual situation, actually, some scientists call uncertainty also the sense of unusual, which I love. We are surprised. And as one neuroscientist told me, no surprise, no learning. So a lot of what we're talking about and that mindset shift and that positive side of uncertainty has to do with learning. I feel like the whole subtext to my book is actually learning, how to learn. But when we learn, we make a new synaptic connection because the old, roots to thinking aren't going to work. When we learn, therefore we remember because we remember because again, we're making new synaptic connections. And that's really actually exactly how people become better at tolerating uncertainty, how they ramp down that fear of uncertainty that I mentioned earlier in the program. Tolerance of uncertainty is a personality trait, and scientists are treating anxiety just through 12 weeks of tolerance of uncertainty training. And that has at its root surprise. So basically, people who have been highly anxious are just asked to try something new. And this is incremental. It's working at the edge of their comfort zone. It's not throwing them at the deep end. So delegate more at work or try a new dish at a restaurant. It sounds so simple, but what they're doing is surprising themselves because they're so intent on the fact that uncertainty is the problem and the blind date will be a failure, as we talked about. And they're, wallowing in their assumptions when they can utilize their surprise. Oh, the blind date was, some are good, some are bad, some are in the middle, etc. When we constantly surprise ourselves about life and also about the nature of uncertainty, that's when we become and I don't like to say comfortable because it's never comfortable to work at the edge of what you know. That's when we become skilled at uncertainty. We're practicing. And that's seeking the unknown. But again, incrementally, seeking surprise is what curiosity is all about. It just couldn't be more exciting because then you're facing the world with wonder and curiosity and even joy and having a lot more fun instead of facing the world with fear.
You're about being
developing new habits. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Developing new habits of mind, right? I mean, you're laying the foundation to do that. Yeah, I was reading this morning an article about helicopter parenting and how there's a college counselor who said she can predict the success of how a high school student will do in college by how the degree of hovering that the parents tend to exhibit, because the parents who are truly helicopter managing their children and making all the decisions for them are depriving their children of the ability to learn independence. Mm-hmm. And really, I think, Maggie, that's another way of looking at how to learn to be surprised in the world and navigate that. And they're denied that opportunity. And those kids are going to be the more anxious kids and have more trouble adjusting. Whereas kids who are allowed greater latitude and independence to fail, to make their own choices, to, you know, go out there and make mistakes and to be surprised and to learn, as you say, learn about the world, learn about themselves in the world. Those are the kids who are more apt to thrive when they leave home. So it's, you know, so true, so very true.
Yeah, and babies actually seek the unfamiliar because they essentially know, and they haven't been schooled out of that curiosity. They know that the babies seek surprise. Yeah. That's why they're learning machines.
Yeah, it was gonna, you mentioned being comfortable, and it made me think back to the uncomfortable, right? It's uncomfortable, but if you think about the uncomfortable conversations or we're always learning something from that uncomfortable situation. And a lot of times those uncomfortable conversations turn out to be positive in the end, right?
Exactly. And I think that this brings in, again, the social side of uncertainty. Rather than staying in our happy place, rather than, you know, trying to avoid discomfort, the nature of a democracy is to move forward despite that discomfort, and to move forward with the discomfort, in other words, with difference, with others, with the unknown. The greatest unknown is each other. And this is one reason why uncertainty is so important on teamwork, because when paired with prolific, judicious, respectful discord, disagreements, dissenting voices, uncertainty is really kind of the rocket fuel for exceptional teams, basically. Teams who, you know, that actually are more creative, more accurate, have more intense discussions. And when people seek in group situations agreement and accord, their actual brain activity is lowered. I call it the love seat of accord. It's so interesting because teams at workplaces that do have lots of prolific, respectful disagreement actually are rated as more energetic. And the brain in disagreement is, scientists call, more energetic, because you are drawing on more parts of your brain. You're trying to process what this difference is. Again, surprise, surprise. So I think that's the social side of uncertainty. It has to be uncomfortable. I call it uncommon ground. We should be seeking uncommon ground. That doesn't mean we all don't have, you know, universal commonality as humans, and we all, you know, respect and need love and, you know, sensitive parenting and et cetera. But it means but it also just means we are missing so much when we miss the differences and explore the differences and are uncertain. Because again, that the uncertainty is what jolts you from your assumptions and allows you to learn and grow.
Right. Peter in Vineyard Haven wonders if you could talk about skepticism.
Do you want to start, Amy, or I have something to say? But
you start. I will come in behind you.
Yeah, I think skepticism, you know, can be another word for wrangling or wielding doubt in positive ways. Maybe Peter knows much more about ancient Greek skeptics, you know, the classic philosophy. I don't know, that much about it, but I think that, you know, skepticism is a really important human, I wouldn't even say trait, but facility that we can, again, wield productively. Skepticism instigates uncertainty, which can be very positive and productive again. So I just think that skepticism is something that, and of course there are guardrails. We need limits to our skepticism. Skepticism unleashed is called cynicism, or nihilism. And so we just because we're in favor of skepticism doesn't mean we want it to be, total and without limits. And I think that's really important today when we're talking about these uncomfortable topics like uncertainty, doubt, and even skepticism.
I certainly agree. I believe that skepticism is, we're dancing on the thin edge of a very sharp sword here. Because when it comes to things like AI-generated deep fakes, deep fake images, skepticism is more important in our culture than ever, that we need to take that moment and question, how real is this? Is this real? What is the agenda behind this? You know, our kids are not being taught how to the critical thinkers and how to analyze media. This is probably one of the most important skills that any citizen of the world needs to acquire right now. Intelligent skepticism or practice skepticism to really sort of figure out what's real and true and what is being driven by an agenda with sort of no real information or fact behind it. However, if we then take too broad a brush and assume that we can trust nothing, exactly as Maggie says, we tip into deep cynicism, which leads to a greater distrust of everything. And we really begin to lose the narrative as to what community means and what sort of a polity means and how we come together over anything. That's a tough dance.
Yeah. Talking about artificial intelligence, talk about the role of uncertainty. And Maggie, you had a whole chapter in your book about AI. Are scientists looking at that? You know, do they believe there should be uncertainty in AI?
Yes, actually, that's so important. And it's not really talked about yet. But so we need uncertainty to be evaluative and skeptical when we are interacting increasingly with AI. At the same time, AI can be beneficial and more intelligent actually when it is uncertain. Now, what do we mean by that? AI is built on these narrow rationalist views of intelligence that are the model or the robot is driven to achieve an outcome however it can in the most linear reward-centric way, it's called. Now uncertainty is probabilistically calculated in order to allow the robot to even operate in an Amazon warehouse. But note the fact that in a road race of robots and humans, or in the factory floor, or in so many different situations in hospitals, robots have to be penned away and separated from humans because they're still dangerous, because the human is an obstacle to gaining certainty and achieving its goal. That's still the predicated. Now, some of the greatest minds in AI right now, Stuart Russell, Yasuo Bento, and dozens of laboratories are creating uncertainty in AI. So in other words, a robot that's unsure of its goals. You want me to fetch coffee, says the housekeeper robot. Well, how? Which route? What kind? What price point? Instead of just, oh, coffee? I'll go. I'll do it. You don't need to help. So the robot that's unsure, and I tested some of these robots in Virginia Tech. It was fascinating. The robot that's unsure can signal its uncertainty about facets of the task and then be teachable on the fly. Current AI is not teachable in the moment, and that's really important. So it's a really important movement to watch.
All right. Maggie Jackson's the author of Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. Amy Bernstein's the author of Wrangling the Doubt Monster, Fighting Fears, Finding Inspiration. We'll have a link with more information to their books at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you both. What a fascinating fast hour that was. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.